It had been a quiet day in the house. The younger agent walked out to his car and drove off the compound, first showing his pass to the gate guards and waiting for the fortified gate to open. A 9-inch square post held the leaves in place and looked strong enough to stop a dump truck. From there he made his way through the concrete barricades on Pennsylvania Avenue, which until fairly recently had been a public street. He turned west and headed toward Georgetown, where he had a loft apartment. But this time he didn't go all the way home. Instead, he turned onto Wisconsin Avenue, then right again to Park. It was vaguely amusing that the man should be a rug merchant. So many Americans thought that Iranians became either terrorists, rug merchants, or impolite physicians. This one had left Persia. But most Americans didn't connect Persian rugs with Iran, as though they were two distinct nations, more than 15 years before. On his wall was a photograph of his son, who, he told those who asked, had been killed in the Iran-Iraq War. That was quite true. He also told those who expressed interest that he hated the government of his former country. That was not true. He was a sleeper agent. He'd never had a single contact with anyone even connected at third hand with Tehran. Maybe he'd been checked out. More likely he had not. He belonged to no association, didn't march, speak out, or otherwise do anything but conduct a prosperous business. Like Raymond, he didn't even attend a mosque. He had, in fact, never met Raymond. And so when the man walked in the front door, his interest only concerned which of his wide selection of handmade rugs the man might want. Instead, after determining that there was no one else in the shop at the moment, his visitor went directly to the counter. "The picture on the wall. He looks like you. Your son?" "Yes," the man replied with a sadness which had never left him, "promises of paradise or not. He was killed in the war. Many lost sons in that conflict. Was he a religious boy?" "Does it matter now?" the merchant asked, blinking hard. "It always matters," Raymond said, in a voice that was totally casual. With that, both men went over to the nearer of two rug piles. The dealer flipped a few corners. "I am in position. I require instructions on timing." Raymond didn't have a code name, and the code phrase he'd just exchanged was only known to three men. The dealer didn't know anything beyond that, except to repeat the 9 words he'd just heard to someone else, then wait for a reply and pass that along. "Would you mind filling out a card for my client list?" That Raymond did, putting down the name and address of a real person. He'd picked the name in the phone book, actually a crisscross directory right in the White House, which had made it easy to select a number that was 1 digit off his own. A tick mark over the 6th digit told the dealer where to add 1 to 3 to get 4, and so complete the call. It was excellent tradecraft, taught to his Savak instructor by an Israeli more than 2 decades earlier and not forgotten, just as neither man from the holy city of Qum had forgotten much of anything. Chapter 22 Time Zones. The size of the earth and the location of the trouble spots made for great inconvenience. America was going to sleep when other parts of the world were just waking up to a new day, a situation made even more difficult by the fact that the people 8 or 9 hours ahead were also the ones making decisions to which the rest of the world had to react. Added to that was the fact that America's vaunted CIA had little in the way of agents or officers to predict what was happening. That left to Stormtrack and Palm Bowl the duty of reporting mainly what the local press and TV were saying. And so while the U.S. president slept, people struggled to collect and analyze information which, when he saw it, would be late by a working day, and the analysis of which might or might not be accurate. Even then, the best of the spooks in Washington were in the main too senior to be stuck with night duty. They had families, after all. and so they also had to be brought up to speed before they could make their own pronouncements, which involved discussion and debate, further delaying presentation of vital national security information. In military terms, it was called having the initiative, making the first move, physical, political, or psychological. How much the better if the other side in the race started off a third of a day behind. Things were slightly better in Moscow, which was only an hour off Tehran time, and in the same time zone with Baghdad. But here for once the RVS, successor to the KGB, was in the same unhappy position as CIA, with nearly all of its networks wiped out in both countries. But for Moscow, the problems were also somewhat closer to home, as Sergei Golovko would find out when his aircraft landed at Sheremetyevo. The largest problem at the moment would be reconciliation. Morning TV in Iraq announced that the new government in Baghdad had informed the United Nations that all international inspection teams were to be given full freedom to visit any facility in the country, entirely without interference. In fact, Iraq requested that the inspections be carried out as rapidly as possible, that full cooperation with any requests would be instantly provided, that the new Baghdad government was desirous of removing any obstacle to full restoration of their country's international trade. For the moment, the neighboring country of Iran, the announcement said, would begin trucking in foodstuffs in accordance with Islamic ancient guidelines on charity for those in need. This in anticipation of the former nation's willingness to re-enter the community of nations. Video copied at Palmbol from Basra TV showed the first convoy of trucks carrying wheat down the twisting Shahabad Highway and crossing into Iraqi territory at the foot of the mountains which separated the two countries. Further pictures showed Iraqi border guards removing their obstacles and waving the trucks through, while their Iranian counterparts stood peacefully aside on their side of the border, no weapons in evidence. At Langley, people ran calculations on the number of trucks, the tonnage of their cargo, and the number of loaves of bread which would result. They concluded that shiploads of wheat would have to be delivered to make more than a symbolic difference. But symbols were important, and the ships were even now being loaded, a set of satellite overheads determined. United Nations officials in Geneva, only 3 hours behind the time, received the Baghdad requests with pleasure and sent immediate orders to their inspection teams, which found Mercedes automobiles waiting for them, to be escorted to the first entries on their inspection lists by wailing police cars. Here they also found TV crews to follow them around, and friendly installation staffs, who professed delight at their newfound ability to tell all they knew and to offer suggestions on how to dismantle, first, a chemical weapons facility disguised as an insecticide plant. Finally, Iran requested a special meeting of the Security Council to consider the lifting of the remaining trade sanctions, something as certain as the rising of the sun, even late, over the American East Coast. Within 2 weeks, the average Iraqi's diet would increase by at least 500 calories. The psychological impact wasn't difficult to figure, and the lead country in restoring normality to the oil-rich but isolated nation was its former enemy, Iran, as always, citing religion as the motivating factor in offering aid. "Tomorrow we will see pictures of bread being distributed for free from mosques," Major Sabah predicted. He could have added the passages from the Koran which would accompany the event, but his American colleagues were not Islamic scholars and would not have grasped the irony terribly well. "Your estimate, sir?" the senior American officer asked. "The two countries will unite," Sabah replied soberly, "and soon." There was no particular need to ask why the surviving Iraqi weapons plants were being exposed. Iran had all it needed. There is no such thing as magic. That was merely the word people used to explain something so cleverly done that there was no ready explanation for it. and the simplest technique employed by its practitioners was to distract the audience with one moving and obvious hand, usually in a white glove, while the other was doing something else. So it was with nations as well. While the trucks rolled, and the ships were loaded, and the diplomats were summoned, and America was waking up to figure out what was going on, it was, after all, evening in Tehran. Badrine's contacts were as useful as ever, and what he could not do, Daryai could. The civilian-marked business jet lifted off from Mehrabad and turned east, heading first over Afghanistan, then Pakistan, in a 2-hour flight that ended at the obscure city of Rutog near the Pakistani-Indian-Kashmiri border. The city was in the former country's Kunlun Mountains, and home to some of China's Muslim population. The border town had an Air Force base with some locally manufactured MiG fighters, and a single landing strip, all separate from the city's small regional airport. The location was ideal for everyone's purpose, as it was a bare 600 miles from New Delhi, though perversely the longest flight came from Beijing, nearly 2,000 miles away, even though the real estate was Chinese-owned. The three aircraft landed a few minutes apart, soon after local sunset, taxied to the far end of the ramp, and parked. Military vehicles took their occupants to the ready room for the local MiG contingent. The Ayatollah Mahmoud Haji Daryai was accustomed to cleaner accommodations, and, worse, he could smell the odor of cooked pork. Always a part of the Chinese diet, but quite nauseating to him. This he put aside. He wasn't the first of the faithful who'd had to treat with pagans and unbelievers. The Indian Prime Minister was cordial. She'd met Daryai before at a regional trade conference and found him withdrawn and misanthropic. That, she saw, had not changed very much. Last to arrive was Zhang Hansan, whom the Indian had met as well. He was a rotund, seemingly jolly man, until one watched his eyes closely. Even his jokes were told with an aim to learn something of his companions. Of the three, he was the only one whose job was not really known to the others. It was clear, however, that he spoke with authority, and since his country was the most powerful of the three, it was not regarded as an insult that a mere minister without portfolio was treating with chiefs of state. The meeting was conducted in English, except for Zhang's dismissal of the general officer who'd handled the greetings.
"Please forgive me for not being here when you arrived. The irregularity in protocol is sincerely regretted."
Tea was served along with some light snacks. There hadn't been time to prepare a proper meal either.
"Not at all," Daryai responded. "Speed makes for inconvenience. For myself, I am most grateful for your willingness to meet under such special circumstances."
He turned.
"And to you, Madam Prime Minister, for joining us. God's blessing on this meeting," he concluded. "My congratulations on developments in Iraq," Zhang said, wondering if the agenda was now entirely in Daryai's hands. So skillfully had he posed the fact that he'd convened the assembly.
"It must be very satisfying after so many years of discord between your two nations."
"Yes," India thought, sipping her tea. "So clever of you to murder the man in such a timely fashion."
"So how may we be of service?" she asked, thus giving Daryai and Iran the floor, to the impassive annoyance of China.
"You've met this Ryan recently. I am interested in your impressions."
"A small man in a large job," she replied at once. "The speech he gave at the funeral, for example, it would have been better suited to a private family ceremony. For a president, bigger things are expected. At the reception later, he seemed nervous and uneasy. And his wife is arrogant. A physician, you see, they often are."
"I found him the same when we met, some years ago," Daryai agreed.
"And yet he controls a great country," Zhang observed.
"Does he?" Iran asked.
"Is America still great? For where comes the greatness of a nation except in the strengths of its leaders?"
and that, the other two knew at once, was the agenda.
"Jesus," Ryan whispered to himself, "this is a lonely place." The thought kept returning to him, all the more so when alone in his office with its curving walls and molded 3-inch doors. He was using his reading glasses all the time now, Kathy's recommendation, but that merely slowed down the headaches. It wasn't as though he were a stranger to reading. Every job he'd held in the past 15 years had required it, but the continual headaches were something new. Maybe he should talk to Kathy or another doc about it. No, Ryan shook his head. It was just job stress, and he just had to learn to deal with it.
Sure, it's just stress, and cancer is just a disease.
The current task was politics. He was reading over a position paper prepared by the political staffers across the street in the OEOB. It was a source of amusement, if not consolation, that they didn't know what to advise him. Ryan had never belonged to a political party. He'd always registered himself as an independent, and that had managed to keep him from getting solicitation letters from the organized parties, though he and Kathy had always ticked the box on their tax returns to contribute their $1 to the government slush fund. But the president was not only supposed to be a member of a party, but also the leader of that party. The parties were even more thoroughly decapitated than the 3 branches of government were. Each of them still had a chairman, neither of whom knew what to do at the moment. For a few days it had been assumed that Ryan was a member of the same party as Roger Durling, and the truth had only been discovered by the press a few days before, to the collective, "Oh, shit," of the Washington establishment. For the ideological mavens of the federal city, it was rather like asking what 2 plus 2 equaled, and finding out that the answer was chartreuse. His position paper was predictably chaotic, the product of 4 or so professional political analysts, and you could tell who had written the different paragraphs, which resolved into a multipath tug of war. Even his intelligence staff did better than this, Jack told himself, tossing the paper into the outbasket and wishing again for a cigarette. That was stress talking, too, he knew. But he still had to go out to the hustings, a word whose meaning he'd never learned, and campaign for people, or at least give speeches, or something. The position paper's guidance hadn't exactly been clear on that. Having already shot himself in the foot on the issue of abortion, higher up and more to the center line, Arnie Van Dam had remarked acidly the previous day to reinforce his earlier lesson, now Ryan would have to make his political stance clear on a multitude of issues. Affirmative action at one end of the alphabet, and welfare at the other, with taxes, the environment, and God only knew what else in between. Once he'd decided where he stood on such things, Callie Weston would write a series of speeches for him to deliver from Seattle to Miami, and God only knew where else in between. Hawaii and Alaska were left out because they were small states in terms of political importance, and poles apart ideologically anyway. They would only confuse matters, or so the position paper told him. "Why can't I just stay here and work, Arnie?" Ryan asked his arriving chief of staff. "Because out there is work, Mr. President." Van Dam took his seat to commence the latest class in Presidency 101. "Because, as you put it, it's a leadership function." "Did I get that right?" Arnie asked with a sardonic growl. "And leading means getting out with the troops, or in this case, the citizens. Are we clear on that, Mr. President?" "Are you enjoying this?" Jack closed his eyes and rubbed them under the glasses. He hated the goddamn glasses, too. "About as much as you are." Which was an altogether fair comment. "Sorry." "Most people who come here genuinely like escaping from this museum and meeting real people. Of course it makes people like Andrea nervous. They'd probably agree with keeping you here all the time." "But it already feels like a prison, doesn't it?" Arnie asked. "Only when I'm awake.
So get out. Meet people. Tell them what you think. Tell them what you want. Hell, they might even listen. They might even tell you what they think, and maybe you will learn something from it. In any case, you can't be president and not do it. Jack lifted the position paper he'd just finished. Did you read this thing? Arnie nodded. Yep. It's confusing garbage, Ryan said, quite surprised. It's a political document. Since when is politics consistent or sensible? He paused. The people I've worked with for the last 20 years got this sort of thing with their mother's milk. Well, they were probably all bottle babies. What? Ask Kathy. It's one of those behavioral theories, that New Age stuff that's supposed to explain everything about everything to everybody everywhere. Politicians are all bottle babies. Mommy never nursed them, and they never bonded properly, felt rejected and all that. And so, as compensation, they go out and make speeches and tell people in different places the different things they want to hear, so that they can get the love and devotion from strangers that their mothers denied them, not to mention the ones like Keelty, who are getting laid all the time. Properly nurtured infants, on the other hand, grow up to become, oh, doctors, I suppose, or maybe rabbis. What the hell? The president nearly shouted. His chief of staff just grinned. Had you going for a second, didn't I? You know, Van Damme went on, I figured out what we really missed when we set this country up. Okay, I'll bite, Jack said, eyes still closed, and finding the humor in the moment. Damn, but Arnie knew how to run a classroom. A court jester. Make it a cabinet post. You know, a dwarf. Excuse me, a male person with an unusually large degree of vertical challenge, dressed in multicolored tights and a funny hat with bells on it. Give him a little stool in the corner. Of course, there isn't a corner here, but what the hell. And every 15 minutes or so, he's supposed to jump up on your desk and shake his rattle in your face just to remind you that you have to take a leak every so often, just like the rest of us. Do you get it now, Jack? No, the president admitted. You dumbass! This job can be fun. Getting out and seeing your citizens is fun. Learning what they want is important, but there's also an exhilaration to it. They want to love you, Jack. They want to support you. They want to know what you think. They most of all want to know that you're one of them. And you know what? You're the first president in one hell of a long time who really is. So get the hell off the bench, tell the air scouts to fire up the big blue bird, and play the damn game. He didn't have to add that the schedule was already set sufficiently in stone, that he couldn't back out. Not everybody will like what I say and believe, Arnie, and I'll be damned if I'm going to lie to people just to kiss ass or get votes or whatever. You expect everybody to love you? Van Damme asked, sardonic again. Most presidents will settle for 51%. Quite a few have had to settle for less. I tore your head off over your abortion statement. Why? Because your statement was confused. No, it wasn't. You going to listen to your teacher or not? Go ahead, the president said. Start off, about 40% of the people vote Democrat. About 40% vote Republican. Of those 80%, most wouldn't change their votes if Adolf Hitler was running against Abe Lincoln. Or against FDR, just to cover both sides. But why? Exasperation. Why is the sky blue, Jack? It just is, okay? Even if you can explain why, and I suppose there is a reason some astronomer can explain, the sky is blue, and so let's just accept the fact, okay? That leaves 20% of the people who swing back one way or another. Maybe they're the true independents, like you. That 20% controls the destiny of the country. And if you want things to happen your way, those are the people you have to reach. Now, here's the funny part. Those 20% don't especially care what you think. This conclusion was delivered with a wry smile. Wait a minute. Arnie held up his hand. You keep interrupting, teacher. The hard 80% that votes the party line doesn't care much about character. They vote party because they believe in the philosophy of the party, or because Mom and Dad always voted that way. The reason doesn't really matter. It happens. It's a fact. Deal with it. Now, back to the 20% that does matter. They care less about what you believe than they do in you. There is your advantage, Mr. President. Politically speaking, you have as much place in this office as a 3-year-old has in a gun shop, but you have character up the ass. That's what we play on. Ryan frowned at the play-on part, but this time kept his peace. He nodded for the chief of staff to go on. Just tell the people what you believe. Make it simple. Good ideas are expressed simply and efficiently. Make it consistent. That 20% wants to believe that you really do believe in what you say. Jack, do you respect a man who says what he believes, even if you disagree with it? Of course, that's what a man is supposed to do, Arnie said, completing the thought. So does the 20%. They will respect you and support you, even though in some cases they disagree with you. Why? Because they will know that you are a man of your word. And they want the occupant of this office to be a man of character and integrity. Because if things go to shit, you can depend on somebody like that to at least try to do the right thing. Oh. The rest is packaging. And don't disparage packaging and handling, okay? There's nothing wrong about being intelligent about how you get your ideas across. In the book you wrote about Halsey, Fighting Sailor, you chose your words carefully to present your ideas, right? The president nodded. So it is with these ideas. Hell, these ideas are even more important, and so you have to package them with proportionately greater skill, don't you? The lesson plan was moving along nicely, the chief of staff thought. Arnie, how many of those ideas will you agree with? Not all of them. I think you're wrong on abortion. A woman should have the right to choose. I bet you and I disagree on affirmative action and a passel of other things. But you know, Mr. President, I've never doubted your integrity for one single minute. I can't tell you what to believe, but you know how to listen. I love this country, Jack. My family escaped from Holland, crossed the English Channel in a boat when I was 3 years old. I can still remember puking my guts out. You're Jewish? Jack asked in surprise. He had no idea what church, if any, Arnie attended. Nope, my father was in the resistance and got himself fingered by a German plant. We skipped just in time, or he would have been shot, and Mom and I would have ended up in the same camps as Anne Frank. Didn't do the rest of the family much good, though. His name was Willem, and after the war ended, he decided that we'd come over here. And I grew up hearing about the old country, and how this place was different. It is different. I became what I am to protect the system. What makes America different? The Constitution, I guess. People change, governments change, ideologies change, but the Constitution stays pretty much the same. You and Pat Martin both swore an oath. So did I, Van Damme went on. Except mine was made to me, and my mom and my dad. I don't have to agree with you on all the issues, Jack. I know you'll try to do the right thing. My job, then, is to protect you so that you can. That means you have to listen, and that you'll sometimes have to do things you don't like. But this job you have, Mr. President, has its own rules. You have to follow them, the chief of staff concluded quietly. How have I been doing, Arnie? Ryan asked, absorbing the largest lesson of the week. Not bad, but you have to do better. Keelty is still an annoyance rather than a real threat to us. Getting out and looking presidential will further marginalize him. Now, something else. As soon as you go out, go off campus, people are going to start asking you about re-election. So what will you say? Ryan shook his head emphatically. I do not want this job, Arnie. Let somebody else take over when... In that case, you're screwed. Nobody will take you seriously. You will not get the people in Congress you want. You will be crippled and unable to accomplish the things you're thinking about. You will become politically ineffective. America cannot afford that, Mr. President. Foreign governments, those are run by politicians, remember, will not take you seriously, and that has national security implications, both immediate and long-term. So what do you say when reporters ask you that question? The president felt like a student holding up his hand in third grade. I haven't decided yet. Correct. You are carrying out your job of reconstituting the government, and that is a question which you will address in due course. I will quietly leak the fact that you're thinking about staying on, that you feel your first duty is to the country, and when reporters ask you about that, you will simply repeat your original position. That sends out a message to foreign governments that they will understand and take seriously, and the American people will also understand and respect it. As a practical matter, the presidential primaries for both parties will not select the marginal candidates who didn't get wiped out on the Hill. They'll vote for uncommitted delegations. We might even want you to speak on that issue. I'll talk that one over with Callie. He didn't add that the media would just love that prospect. Covering two brokered, wide-open political conventions was a dream such as few of them had ever dared to consider. Arnie was keeping it as simple as he could. No matter what positions Ryan took, as soon as he took them, no less than 40% of the people would object to it, and probably more. The funny thing about the 20% he kept harping on was that they covered the whole political spectrum. Like himself, less concerned with ideology than with character. Some of them would object vociferously, and in that they would be indistinguishable from whichever 40% grouping shared that particular ideological stance, though at the end of the day they would vote the man. They always did, honest people that they were, placing country before prejudice. But joining in a process that most often honestly selected people who lacked the honor of their electors. Ryan didn't yet grasp the opportunity he held in his hands, and it was probably better that he didn't, for in thinking about it too much, perhaps at all, he would try to control the spin, which he'd never learned to do well. Even honorable men could make mistakes, and Ryan was no different from the rest. That was why people like Arnold Van Damme existed, to teach and to guide from the inside and the outside of the system at the same time. He looked at his president, noting the confusion that came along with new thoughts. He was trying to make sense of it, and he'd probably succeed, because he was a good listener and a particularly adept processor of information. He wouldn't see it through to the natural conclusion, however. Only Arnie and maybe Callie Weston were able to look that far into the future. In the past weeks, Van Damme had decided that Ryan had the makings of a real president. It would be his job, the chief of staff decided, to make sure that Jack stayed here. "We cannot do that," the Indian Prime Minister protested, with the admission. "We only recently had a lesson from the American Navy."
"It was a harsh one," Zhang agreed, "but it did no permanent harm. I believe the damage to your ships will be made good in 2 more weeks."
That statement turned India's head around. She'd learned that fact herself only a few days earlier. The repairs were using up a sizable portion of the Indian Navy's annual operating budget, which had been her principal concern. It wasn't every day that a foreign country, particularly one which had once been a shooting enemy, revealed its penetration of another's government.
"America is a facade, a giant with a sick heart and a damaged brain," Daryai said. "You told us yourself, Prime Minister. President Ryan is a small man in a large job. If we make the job larger and harder, then America will lose its ability to interfere with us for a long enough time that we can achieve our goals. The American government is paralyzed, and will remain so for some weeks to come. All we need do is to increase the degree of paralysis."
"And how might one do that?" India asked.
"Through the simple means of stretching their commitments while at the same time disturbing their internal stability. On the one hand, mere demonstrations will suffice on your part. On the other, that is my concern. It is better, I think, that you have no knowledge of it."
Had he been able to do so, Zhang would not even have breathed at the moment, the better to control his feelings. It wasn't every day that he met someone more ruthless than himself, and no, he didn't want to know what Daryai had in mind. Better for another country to commit an act of war.
"Do go on," he said, reaching inside his jacket for a cigarette.
"Each of us represents a country with great abilities and greater needs. China and India have large populations and need both space and resources. I will soon have resources, and the capital that comes with them, and also the ability to control how both are distributed. the United Islamic Republic will become a great power, as you are already great powers. The West has dominated the East for too long. Daryai looked directly at Zhang. To our north is a rotting corpse. Many millions of the faithful are there and require liberation. There are also resources and space which your country needs. These I offer to you, if you will in turn offer the lands of the faithful to me. Then he looked at the Indian Prime Minister. To your south lies an empty continent with the space and resources you need. For your cooperation, I think the United Islamic Republic and the People's Republic are willing to offer their protection. From each of you I ask only quiet cooperation without direct risk. India remarked to herself that she'd heard that one before, but her needs had not changed from before either. China immediately came up with a means of providing a distraction that offered little in the way of danger. It had happened before. Iran. What was this United Islamic Republic? Oh, of course, Zhang thought. Of course. The UIR would take all the real risks, though it would seem that those were unusually well calculated. He would do his own check of the correlation of forces on his return to Beijing. I ask no commitments at this point, obviously. You will need to assure yourselves that I am serious in my abilities and intentions. I do ask that you give full consideration to my proposed informal alliance. Pakistan, the Prime Minister said, foolishly tipping her hand, Zhang thought. Islamabad has been an American puppet for too long and cannot be trusted, Daryai replied at once, having thought that one through already, though he hadn't really expected India to jump so readily. This woman hated America as much as he did. Well, the lesson, as she'd called it, must have injured her pride even more deeply than his diplomats had told him. How typical for a woman to value her pride so highly. And how weak. Excellent. He looked over at Zhang. Our arrangements with Pakistan are commercial only, and as such are subject to modification, China observed, equally delighted at India's weakness. It was no one's fault but her own. She'd committed forces to the field, well, the sea, in support of Japan's inefficient attack on America, while China had done nothing and risked nothing, and emerged from the war unhurt and uninvolved. Even Zhang's most cautious superiors had not objected to his play, failed though it was. And now, again, someone else would take the risks, and India would move in pacifist support, and China would have to do nothing but repeat an earlier policy that seemingly had nothing to do with this new UIR, but was rather a test of a new American president. And that sort of thing happened all the time anyway. Besides, Taiwan was still an annoyance. It was so curious. Iran, motivated by religion, of all things. India, motivated by greed and anger. China, on the other hand, thought for the long term, dispassionately, seeking what really mattered, but with circumspection as always. Iran's goal was self-evident, and if Daryai was willing to risk war for it, then why not watch in safety and hope for his success? But he wouldn't commit his country now. Why appear too eager? India was eager, enough so to overlook the obvious. If Daryai was successful, then Pakistan would make its peace with the new UIR, perhaps even join it, and then India would be isolated and vulnerable. Well, it was dangerous to be a vassal, and all the more so if you had aspirations to graduate to the next level, but without the wherewithal to make it happen. One had to be careful choosing allies. Gratitude among nations was a hothouse flower, easily wilted by exposure to the real world. The Prime Minister nodded in acknowledgment of her victory over Pakistan and said no more. In that case, my friends, I thank you for graciously agreeing to meet with me, and with your permission, I will take my leave. The three stood. Handshakes were exchanged, and they headed to the door.
Minutes after that, Daryai's aircraft rotated off the bumpy fighter strip. The mullah looked at the coffee pot and decided against it. He wanted a few hours of sleep before morning prayers. But first, your predictions were entirely correct. The Russians call these things objective conditions. They are and remain unbelievers, but their formulas for analysis of problems have a certain precision to them, Badrine explained. That is why I have learned to assemble information so carefully.
So I have seen. Your next task will be to sketch in some operations.
With that, Daryai pushed back his seat and closed his eyes, wondering if he would dream again of dead lions. Much as he wished for a return to clinical medicine, Pierre Alexander didn't especially like it, at least this matter of treating people who would not survive. The former army officer in him figured that defending Bataan had been like this. Doing all you could, firing off your best rounds, but knowing that relief would never come. At the moment, it was 3 AIDS patients, all homosexual men, all in their 30s, and all with less than a year to live. Alexander was a fairly religious man, and he didn't approve of the gay lifestyle. But nobody deserved to die like this. And even if they did, he was a physician, not God sitting in judgment. Damn, he thought, walking off the elevator and speaking his patient notes into a mini-tape recorder. It's part of a doctor's job to compartmentalize his life. The 3 patients on his unit would still be there tomorrow, and none of them would require emergency attention that night. Putting their problems aside was not cruel. It was just business. And their lives, were they to have any hope at all, would depend on his ability to turn away from their stricken bodies and back to researching the micro-sized organisms that were attacking them. He handed the tape cassette to his secretary, who'd type up the notes. Dr. Lawrence down in Atlanta returned your call, returning his call, returning your original call, she told him as he passed. As soon as he sat down, he dialed the direct line from memory. Yes?
Gus! Alex here at Hopkins. Tag, he chuckled. You're it.
He heard a good laugh at the other end of the line. Phone tag could be the biggest pain in the ass.
How's the fishing, Colonel? Would you believe I haven't had a chance yet? Ralph's working me pretty hard.
What did you want from me?
You did call first, didn't you?
Lawrence wasn't sure anymore, another sign of a man working too hard.
"Yeah, I did, Gus. Ralph tells me you're starting a new look at the Ebola structure, from that mini-break in Zaire, right?"
"Well, I would be, except somebody stole my monkeys," the director of CDC reported sourly. "The replacement shipment is due in here in a day or two, so they tell me."
"You have a break-in?" Alexander asked.
One of the troublesome developments for labs that had experimental animals was that animal rights fanatics occasionally tried to bust in and liberate the animals. Someday, if everyone wasn't careful, some screwball would walk out with a monkey under his arm and discover it had Lassa fever, or worse. How the hell were physicians supposed to study the goddamn bug without animals? And who'd ever said that a monkey was more important than a human being? The answer to that was simple. In America, there were people who believed in damn near anything, and there was a constitutional right to be an ass. Because of that, CDC, Hopkins, and other research labs had armed guards protecting monkey cages, and even rat cages, which really made Alex roll his eyes to the ceiling. No, they were hijacked in Africa. Somebody else is playing with them now. Anyway, so it kicks me back a week. What the hell? I've been looking at this little bastard for 15 years.
How fresh is the sample?
It's off the index, patient. Positive identification, Ebola Zaire, the Mayinga strain. We have another sample from the only other patient. That one disappeared.
What?
Alexander asked in immediate alarm.
Lost at sea in a plane crash. They were evidently flying her to Paris to see Rousseau.
No further cases, Alex. We dodged the bullet this time for a change, Lawrence assured his younger colleague.
Better, Alexander thought, to crunch in a plane crash than bleed out from that little fucker.
He still thought like a soldier,
profanity and all.
Okay.
So, why did you call?
Polynomials, Lawrence heard.
What do you mean, the doctor asked in Atlanta.
When you map this one out, let's think about doing a mathematical analysis of the structure.
I've been playing with that idea for a while. Right now, though, I want to examine the reproduction cycle and...
Exactly, Gus, the mathematical nature of the interaction. I was talking to a colleague up here, eye cutter, you believe. She said something interesting. If the amino acids have a quantifiable mathematical value, and they should, then how they interact with other codon strings may tell us something.
Alexander paused and heard a match striking. Gus was smoking his pipe in the office again.
Keep going. Still reaching for this one, Gus. What if it's like you've been thinking? It's all an equation. The trick is cracking it, right? How do we do that? Okay, Ralph told me about your time cycle study. I think you're onto something. If we have the virus RNA mapped, and we have the host DNA mapped, then...
Gotcha. The interactions will tell us something about the values of the elements in the polynomial.
And that will tell us a lot about how the little fuck replicates, and just maybe...
how to attack it.
A pause and a loud puff came over the phone line.
Alex, that's pretty good.
You're the best guy for the job, Gus, and you're setting up the experiment anyway.
Something's missing, though.
Always is.
Let me think about that one for a day or so and get back to you.
Good one, Alex.
Thank you, sir.
Professor Alexander replaced the phone and figured he'd done his duty of the day for medical science. It wasn't much, and there was an element missing from the suggestion.
Chapter 23 Experiments. It took several days to get everything in place. President Ryan had to meet with yet another class of new senators. Some of the states were a little slow in getting things done, mainly because some of the governors established something akin to search committees to evaluate a list of candidates. That was a surprise to a lot of Washington insiders, who'd expected the state executives to do things as they'd always been done, to appoint replacements to the upper house just as soon as the bodies were cold. But it turned out that Ryan's speech had mattered a little bit. Eight governors had realized that this situation was unique, and had therefore acted in a different way, earning, on reflection, the praise of their local papers, if not the complete approval of the establishment press. Jack's first political trip was an experimental one. He rose early, kissed his wife and kids on the way out the door, and boarded the helicopter on the south lawn just before 7 in the morning. 10 minutes later, he left the aircraft to trot up the stairs onto Air Force One, technically known to the Pentagon as a VC-25A, a 747 expensively modified to be the president's personal conveyance. He boarded just as the pilot, a very senior colonel, was making his airline-like pre-flight announcements. Looking aft, Ryan could see 80 or so reporters belting into their better-than-first-class leather seats. Actually, some didn't strap in, because Air Force One generally rode more smoothly than an ocean liner on calm seas. And when he turned to head forward, he heard, "And this is a non-smoking flight."
"Who said that?" the president asked.
"One of the TV pukes," Andrea replied. "He thinks it's his airplane."
"In a way it is," Arnie pointed out. "Remember that."
"That's Tom Donner," Callie Weston added, "the NBC anchor. His personal feces are not odorific, and he uses more hairspray than I do. But part of it's glued on."
"This way, Mr. President."
Andrea pointed forward. The president's cabin in Air Force One is in the extreme nose on the main deck, where there are regular, if very plush, seats, plus a pair of couches that fold out into beds for long trips. As the principal agent watched, her principal strapped in. Passengers could get away with breaking the rules. The USSS wasn't all that concerned with journalists, but not POTUS. When that was done, she waved to an Air Force crewman, who lifted a phone and told the pilot that he could go now. With that, the engine started up. Jack had mostly lost his fear of flying, but this was the part of the flight where he closed his eyes and thought, earlier in his life he'd whispered,
a prayer for the collective safety of the people aboard, in the belief that praying merely for yourself might appear selfish to God. About the time that was finished, the takeoff roll began, rather more quickly than was normal on a 747. Lightly loaded, it felt like an airplane instead of a train pulling out of a station. "Okay," Arnie said as the nose lifted off. The President studiously did not grip the armrests as he usually did. "This is going to be an easy one. Indianapolis, Oklahoma City, and back home for dinner. The crowds will be friendly and about as reactionary as you are," he added with a twinkle. "So you don't really have anything to worry about." Special Agent Price, sitting in the same compartment for the takeoff, hated it when anybody said that. Chief of Staff Van Damme, carpenter to the Secret Service, Callie Weston was Calliope, was one of the staffers who never quite appreciated the headaches the service went through. He thought of danger as a political hazard even after the 747 crash. Remarkable, she thought. A few feet aft, Agent Raymond was in an aft-facing seat watching access forward, in case a reporter showed up with a gun instead of a pencil. There were 6 more agents aboard to keep an eye on everyone, even the uniformed crewmen, and a platoon of them standing by in each of the 2 destination cities, along with a huge collection of local cops. At Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma City, the fuel truck was already under USSS guard, lest someone contaminate the JP to go into the presidential aircraft. It would remain so until well after the 747 returned to Andrews. A C-5B Galaxy transport was already in Indianapolis, having ferried the presidential automobiles there. Moving the president around was rather like transporting the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus, except people generally didn't worry about people trying to assassinate the man on the flying trapeze. Ryan, Agent Price saw, was going over his speech. That was one of his few normal acts. They were almost always nervous about speeches. Generally, not so much stage fright as concern for the content spin. The thought made Price smile. Ryan wasn't worried about the content, but was worried about blowing the delivery. Well, he'd learn. And his good fortune was that Callie Weston, administrative pain in the ass that she was, wrote one hell of a speech. "Breakfast?" a steward asked, now that the aircraft was leveled off. The president shook his head. "Not hungry, thanks." "Get him ham and eggs, toast and decaf," Van Damme ordered. "Never try to give a speech on an empty stomach," Callie advised. "Trust me." "And not too much real coffee. Caffeine can make you jumpy. When a president gives a speech," Arnie explained for this morning's lesson, "he's..." "Callie, help me out here." "Nothing dramatic for these 2 today. You're the smart neighbor coming over because the guy next door wants your advice on something he's been thinking about. Friendly, reasonable, quiet." "Gee, Fred, I really think you might want to do it this way," Weston explained with raised eyebrows.
"Kindly family doctor telling a guy to go easy on the greasy food and maybe play an extra round of golf. Exercise is supposed to be fun, that sort of thing," the chief of staff explained on. "You do it all the time in real life."
"Just do it this morning in front of 4,000 people, right?" Ryan asked. "And C-SPAN cameras, and it'll be on all the evening network news broadcasts. CNN will be doing it live, too, 'cause it's your first speech out in the country," Callie added. No sense lying to the man. "Jesus." Jack looked back down at the text of his speech. "You're right, Arnie. Better decaf." He looked up suddenly. "Any smokers aboard?" It was the way he asked it that made the Air Force steward turn. "Want one, sir?" The answer was somewhat shameful, but... "Yes." She handed him a Virginia Slim and lit it with a warm smile. It wasn't every day one got a chance to provide so personal a service to the Commander-in-Chief. Ryan took a puff and looked up. "If you tell my wife, Sergeant..." "Our secret, sir." She disappeared aft to get breakfast, her day already made. The fluid was surprisingly horrid in color, deep scarlet with a hint of brown. They'd monitored the process with small samples under an electron microscope. The monkey kidneys exposed to the infected blood were composed of discrete and highly specialized cells. And, for whatever reason, Ebola loved those cells as a glutton loves his chocolate mousse. It had been both fascinating and horrifying to watch. The micron-sized virus strands touched the cells, penetrated them, and started to replicate in the warm, rich biosphere. It was like something from a science fiction movie, but quite real. This virus, like all the others, was only equivocally alive. It could act only with help, and that help had to come from its host, which, by providing the means for the virus to activate, also conspired at its own death. The Ebola strands contained only RNA, and for mitosis to take place, both RNA and DNA are required. The kidney cells had both. The virus strands sought them out, and when they were joined, the Ebola started to reproduce. To do that required energy, and that energy was supplied by the kidney cells, which were, of course, completely destroyed in the process. The multiplication process was a microcosm of the disease process in a human community. It started slowly, then accelerated geometrically. The faster it went, the faster it went. 2, 4, 16, 256, 65,536, until all of the nutrients were eaten up, and only virus strands remained, then went dormant and awaited their next opportunity. People applied all manner of false images to disease. It would lie in wait for its chance. It would kill without mercy. It would seek out victims. All of that was anthropomorphic rubbish, Mahudi and his colleague knew. It didn't think. It didn't do anything overly malevolent. All Ebola did was to eat and reproduce and go back to its dormant state. But as a computer is only a collection of electrical switches which can only distinguish between the numerals 1 and 0, but does so more rapidly and efficiently than its human users, so Ebola was supremely well adapted to reproduce so rapidly that the human body's immune system, ordinarily a ruthlessly effective defense mechanism, was simply overwhelmed, as though by an army of carnivorous ants. In that lay Ebola's historic weakness. It was too efficient. It killed too fast. Its survival mechanism within the human host also tended to kill the host before it could pass the disease along. It was also super-adapted to a specific ecosystem. Ebola didn't survive long in the open, and only then in a jungle environment. For this reason, and since it could not survive in a human host without killing that host in 10 days or less, it had also evolved slowly, without taking the next evolutionary step of becoming airborne. Or so everyone thought. Perhaps hoped would be a better word, Mahudi reflected. An Ebola variant that could be spread by aerosol would be catastrophically deadly. It was possible they had exactly that. This was the Mayinga strain, as repeated microscopy had established, and that strain was suspected to be capable of aerosol transmission. And that was what they had to prove. Deep freezing, using liquid nitrogen as the refrigerant, for example, killed most normal human cells. When they froze, the expansion of the water, which accounted for most of the cellular mass, burst the cell walls, leaving nothing behind but wreckage. Ebola, on the other hand, was too primitive for that to happen. Too much heat could kill it. Ultraviolet light could kill it. Microchanges in the chemical environment could kill it. But give it a cold, dark place to sleep, and it was content to slumber in peace. They worked in a glove box. It was a highly controlled and lethally contaminated environment bordered with clear Lexan strong enough to stop a pistol bullet. On two sides, holes were cut into the sturdy plastic, and riveted at each workstation was a pair of heavy rubber gloves. Mahudi withdrew 10 cc's of the virus-rich liquid and transferred it to a small container, which he sealed. The sluggishness of the process was less from physical danger than from the awkwardness of the gloves. When the container was sealed, he transferred it from one gloved hand to another, then off to the director, who performed a similar switch, finally moving it into a small airlock.
When that door was closed, as indicated by a light which read off a pressure sensor, the small compartment was flooded with disinfectant spray, dilute phenol, and allowed to sit for 3 minutes until it was certain that the air and the transfer container were safe to release. Even then, no one would touch it with ungloved hands.